This is the true meaning of satsang, because satsang means the gathering of truth. Sat is truth, sang is gathering. And the only truth is the impersonal awareness of being. I am. If your memory was wiped out right now, if I pressed a button and wiped out your entire memory, you would not remember your name, but you would know that you are. Which means that everything after that impersonal awareness of being is a concept. So it is not individuals who come together in a gathering of truth, though it appears that way. The coming together has happened in the light of this consciousness, without which none of us would be here. So satsang honors that. One feels at home in a satsang because one leaves all one's projections and masks behind. That is why it feels like a coming home, because it's quite tiring to wear different masks during the course of the day. The only time we don't wear a mask is when we are in deep sleep. That is why deep sleep is so peaceful. So it becomes a dropping away, not an acquiring of knowledge, but dropping away of all that has been acquired through the process of life. Why do we say children are so pure? Why does our heart reach out to children? Because they have not acquired that much of personality, of likes and dislikes, of judgments. Balakrishna refers to the child consciousness, which has not left us, but layers have been created over it. Layers of doership, layers of me and my story, and the journey of illusion has begun. And the journey is a journey of relationships. Relationships with others, my parents, my siblings, children, friends, colleagues, the beggar on the street, the stranger whom I have just met, because the other and you are in it together, equally. Because that is the design of life. The design of life is duality. We accept so easily up and down, left and right, front and back, black and white, rich and poor, pleasure and pain as the design of life. Therefore, me and the other, inseparable, though it appears we are separate. So everyone you like and everyone you dislike is not separate from you in that sense. This understanding itself starts the journey of healing. And when one is exposed to a teaching like this, it truly becomes a gift, because it transforms one's relationship with others. Life is as it is complicated. Why not make it little simpler by just understanding that the same energy, the same consciousness functions through everyone? If you are hurt by someone, you were meant to be hurt. The other was an instrument through whom the hurt happened. Someone sent me a mail on the four aspects of control and free will in one's life. What can we control, what can't we control, and the various degrees of these four aspects. But if your own breath is not in your control, which is the foundation of your existence, then what degree of control are you referring to? Are you controlling the pumping of your heart? Are you controlling what the next moment will bring? The phone rings. Do you know who it is at the other end and what they will say? Good news or bad news? Can you control that? We all have seen enough in life, except him, to understand that there is no point running after pleasures, because life has shown us that life is pleasure and pain. We may be inclined towards running after pleasures, but we know that we can't derive our happiness from them because they don't last. So when you start accepting pain as a part of life, you don't create more psychological suffering for yourself, because you know this is the flow of life. Maharaj said, between the banks of pleasure and pain, my life flows. Can it flow with only one bank, the river? Has God promised you a life of pleasures? So what starts happening is, when one is not swayed that much by the pleasures and pains of life, one sees that pleasures and pains come and go. So one starts witnessing the flow of life, which creates a shift in perspective, because earlier one was deep into what happens to me. Now one witnesses everything moving across the screen of consciousness. That is the birth of witnessing, because the understanding is there that for every pleasure and pain I have come across, I have to be there first. So when you start depending less and less on these pleasures and pains, etc., what is actually happening is that you are abiding in your own presence and in your being. You start abiding in your being, because you have the understanding now that if a pleasure comes, I will thank God for it. I will enjoy it while it lasts. But you know that pleasures do not last. And if you are suffering, you thank God for your suffering, because you know that there are millions more below the poverty line who are suffering far more than I am. Thank you, God. Thank you, God, for the simple things in life. That starts becoming your mantra. And to abide in one's being, to rest in the presence, is to rest in one's own consciousness. Ramesh, in one of his early books, had said, we protect what is dearest to us. It's natural. So what is dearest to us? Your own consciousness, because without that, you're not there. Can you enjoy a pleasure if you're not conscious? So how would you protect your consciousness? What does that mean actually? If you have a child, you look after the child, right? So to protect your consciousness means to always be aware that you are conscious, to stay focused in the awareness, in the presence of being, not being this or that, but being. That is why Maharaj would say, the only practice I recommend is to abide in your beingness, in your I am. Something which really doesn't have to be done, because you are already that. It is just the thinking mind which is running away into an imaginary future or a dead past, which starts getting centered. When the thinking mind starts getting centered, you are abiding in your beingness. It is nothing to be acquired, because it is your very nature. Peace is your very nature. You cannot acquire peace. Your nature is one of peace. The thinking mind cannot acquire peace like an object, because it is the annihilation of the thinking mind which results in the peace shining through. The me cannot be at peace. Peace is the absence of the me, which is the thinking mind. If you go to a sage and you say, I feel so peaceful here. It is not that the sage as a me is peaceful. The sage is pure presence. And that is what attracts you, touches you. Why? Because you also know what it is to be peaceful. Otherwise, how can you say someone else is peaceful? You must know what it is, right? You must know what it is to be peaceful. Even though you may not be at peace, but if you see the sage, you meet the sage and say, I feel so peaceful in his presence. You feel it because that peace is inside you. Peace is not a state of mind, it is a vibration. That is why you feel peaceful. That is why when Ramana Maharshi was asked, how do I know a sage is a sage? He replied, by the degree of peace that you feel in his presence and the sense of respect that you feel for him. And why did Maharaj, when he was asked, is there any benefit in sitting with a guru physically? His reply was, the trees around a sandalwood tree in a forest start emitting the same fragrance. It is the thinking mind which subsides in their presence. A girl used to come here and then she sent me a mail saying that every time I come here, I feel so sleepy and drowsy. So first I told her, you must be getting very bored. But she said, no, I don't get bored, but why do I feel so drowsy and sleepy when I sit here for an hour? Because it is the thinking mind which is going to sleep. You will see it in many satsangs, in many spiritual talks. People have this urge to lie down, to sleep, because the mind is quietening down. When your mind is active, can you sleep at night? So you want to sleep when the mind is not active. Everything is a vibration which has got solidified as forms. These are all vibrations here. This is a vibration. The Shivalinga is the primal vibration, the ellipsoid. The ellipsoid, which is like you could see an oval or an egg, is what we are if we don't look at the form. It's a vibratory field pulsating. Words are vibrations. The words you utter are vibrations. They are not words in that sense. Think of any bad word in your mind. Any bad word. Okay? Now, in your mind, say that bad word very slowly. Now, if someone called you that in that slow way, would you get offended? Think about it. The bad word you have chosen, if I say it very slowly, supposing there's the word peace, and I say, peace. Now think of that bad word that way. If someone called you that, would you be upset? You wouldn't, because the vibration has changed. So the vibration of a mind which is overactive and thinking too much is quite different from the vibration of a mind which is at rest. And then when you get a taste of that, you see, everything is so vast and clear and pristine. What you look at, what you see, what you feel. Look at the sun and the sky. You see the vastness only when the mind is truly still. Otherwise, you're just seeing an object which you call the sun and behind it what you call the sky. But can you just imagine the vastness of vision? And how do you know it's so vast? How do you know your vision is so vast? You can only know it if you are vaster than that. How vast must you be to know the vision is so vast? You know, now we have these new forms of technology where you do live streaming and all these other things can be done. I remember long back in the year 2003 or 4, mobile phones had just come out in India, I think around that time. And I had gone to Glastonbury, UK, to attend a talk of Eckhart Tolle's in those days. So one evening, we were walking, just four or five of us, and he had to call, I think, his mother, you know. And I had the mobile phone, and I said, we can make a call. And he said, you know, it's just technology is so amazing. I mean, keep the mobile phone aside. He said, I just don't understand how someone is in one country far, far, far away, we are here, and yet on the phone you hear the same voice. Isn't it amazing? The same person's voice you hear. It's a real wonder, you know. It can be explained away as vibrations and this and that. But what is that which knows that there's one voice thousands of miles away which one is hearing right in one's ear? That has to be even more away, and yet even more closer for you to hear it. So is there anything apart from you? This voice you are hearing, speaking now, isn't it appearing in your own consciousness? Is there anything outside your consciousness? Is there anything outside of you? Is the person you dislike outside of you? Is the person you love outside of you? Yes, Niranjan, does it make any sense? What brings you here? It's your first time? You're from Bombay. So what brings you here? Which one is Gajanan? He is the culprit. And what brings you here? Sorry, that's for the recording of the...
Yesterday I heard a few of your talks said...
Okay. And this boy is with you? Oh, he's your son?
He said he wanted to come. So he was just interested. He said I wanted to come.
Really?
Yeah.
How old is he? How old are you?
He's 8 years old.
8 years. He's comfortable in English or Hindi or?
Yeah, Hindi.
Hindi.
But just on a, maybe a presence.
So you haven't forced him to come?
No, I haven't forced. He wanted to come.
Idhar, kaise laga idhar? You know, once in my teacher's satsang, one couple had come with a very young child. Now, in his hall, they had a swing. So the child went and sat on the swing. And I kid you not, for that 1.5 hours of satsang, the child sat so happily swinging, looking out, really enjoying, okay? And the parents were not very close to the child. They were a bit far away. Now, at the end, you know, everyone was took 5 minutes to meet each other and all that. And some went up to the child, you know. It was very sweet. But somebody went up to the parent and said, because I was astonished by this, what is wrong with your child? So the mother was not, you know, I think they were French, I'm not sure. But the mother said, excuse me, I mean, you know, she didn't understand. He said, because this child should not be sitting like this. The child should be making noise, running around, creating a nuisance, should be wanting to play. So the mother told this man very nicely that, look, my child has always been like this. But see what we do. We have a preconceived idea of what children should be like. Children should be running around. Children should be doing this, should be creating noise, should not be comfortable sitting by themselves. That is what happens. That is what the adult starts projecting onto what was a child having a blast looking at everyone, looking at the old man, chatting there to everyone, looking out of the window. Was just simple being and joy became so complicated with concepts. That is what we do. Life can really be very simple, you know, but we complicate it. We don't want people to be themselves. We want to change people. We want people to be a certain way, the way we want them to be. I don't think you should have said that. I think you should have behaved that way. I don't like what you did. I would have been happier if you, instead of using these words, you used those words. Me, 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 me. The mantra of the me, which doesn't want people to be themselves the way God has made them. Because we think we know better than God. Little realizing that God has even created our conditioning, our thought processes, our genetics, on the basis of which we say things and take decisions. That goes out of the window. And it must be a very big window, because we keep throwing things out of the window like that. This obsession with this me and the way things should be, the way I want them to be, starts dropping away. And you enjoy the flow of life. Once I remember another incident at Ramesh's time. So his father had built the building in which they were living. And I was helping him edit some of his books. So one evening I had gone. The satsangs were in the morning, but I said I'll come around 4:30. I have some questions. So I was sitting with him in his living room and the doorbell rang. And so he went and opened the door. And there was a boy outside who was very agitated. And I overheard the whole conversation because the sofa was just behind the door. Now it so happened, this was a very rich boy, okay? And his complaint was that his Mercedes-Benz, which was parked below the building, all the four tires had been punctured by the watchman of the building because he was not supposed to park there. So he was extremely agitated. So Ramesh, being very pragmatic, said, look here, first of all, I am no longer in charge. I'll give you the number of the secretary of the building or whatever. You talk to him. I understand what you're saying, but I am not the one to take any decision on this. But this boy was really furious, you know. So Ramesh said, okay, slow down. Tell me what happened. So he said, earlier your watchman has punctured only one tire. So if he had punctured one tire, I would have been fine. So Ramesh told him, look here, he must have reached a point of frustration. So he punctured all four tires. I really apologize, but once again, I'm not the right person, you know, and I'm sitting with someone. So he said, no, he was extremely upset. He said, I may be wrong, but your watchman has punctured all four tires, this is incorrect. So Ramesh said, do you have another car in case you're going somewhere? He said, I have three cars. So Ramesh said, why don't you use the other car? He said, that's not the point. All four tires were punctured. Fourth time I heard Ramesh saying, you know, I will give you the number. So then what Ramesh did is, he said, you just wait here. And the boy kept on talking, but Ramesh went, got a slip of paper, wrote the number down, and he was bringing it to bring the boy. Now the boy saw me sitting there. So he said, oh, I'm really sorry to have disturbed your morning with your father. Now I thought Ramesh was around 89 years old then. I was about 30, so I said, he's not my father. He said, oh, I'm so sorry. I said, he's my grandfather. Because I don't know how he thought Ramesh was my father. So anyway, Ramesh gave him that slip. In all seriousness, with all respect, he said, I'm really sorry, I'm not the right person. And then Ramesh wished him well, you know. The minute Ramesh closed the door, he looked at me and he burst out laughing. And we had a good laugh. What does that mean? Means you can only do things to a certain point. Beyond that, it's not in your control. And here we had someone who was very rich, who had many cars, who was parking in the wrong place, who was just out of this anxiety and frustration, probably wanted to just tell someone about what he was feeling. But beyond a point, one can't do anything. So that is called living with the lightness of being. Ramesh didn't say, oh, he wasted our time, I'm so sorry, he was upset, he upset me also, he should not have done that, why did he call me, this is not correct. None of that dialogue happened. What the present moment offered was honored. To the degree he could help, he helped. Matter is closed. There are no judgments. We get stuck in our judgments. Who does this fellow think he is? Uska baap kaun hai? That's what we start doing. How dare he do this? That is where our dialogue is. But one has to let go. Just let go. Let things be as they are. It's the journey of letting go. Let it all go. I asked you what brings you here, and I asked him what brings him here. Consciousness has brought you here. It appears otherwise. You happen to see something or hear something which you liked. If that had not happened, you wouldn't be here. Did you have any control? Did you have any control in hearing my videos? Or did you come across them? If that had not happened, he would not have been here. That is the flow of life. You will only be where you are if it is destined to be that way. And what you heard appealed to you enough for you to come here. Did you have any control over that? You could have said, this is rubbish. See how compassionate consciousness is. It's a love affair. It's an infinite love affair which has no beginning and no end. No greater love. Gajanan is another name of Ganpati, right? Ganpati is behind me and now in front of me also. No greater blessing than that for me. And I have a nose also like a Ganpati. Names are vibrations. Gajanan is a vibration. Niranjan is a vibration. Jigar is a vibration. Indian names are quite beautiful, huh? What say Dipesh? Asha is, my hope is right at the back there. Always shining its light on me. What's your name? Benjamin.
Yeah,
not so Indian. No, you are from?
France.
Which part?
Paris.
Oh, I have some very close friends in Paris. Yeah. One is at, what is that road called? You know where near the Arc de Triomphe, there's a very big street which turns left. I've forgotten the name. No.
Champs-Élysées.
No, not Champs-Élysées.
Camille Wagram?
Yes, Wagram. Yeah. And another friend used to stay in Vélizy, which is a neighborhood, right? A suburb. Vélizy, Villa Coublay used to stay. Now he's shifted. We had visited the cathedrals of France, the old cathedrals. We drove from Paris down to Toulouse through the Loire Valley. And then we went to Mont-Saint-Michel, which was very special. That is dedicated to the Archangel Michael, Mont-Saint-Michel.
A rope that goes underwater at high tide.
Yes, that's right. Michael actually translates to he who is as God. Mikhail. he who is as God. And you know what his symbol is? The sun. What we call in our Indian scriptures, the only visible God, visible Brahman, the sun. Naam kya hai? Siddharth. Arre wah. See the gathering? Aren't we all blessed? Siddharth, you know the story of Siddhartha Gautama and the swan. Swan malum hai? What is swan in Hindi? Hans. Do you all know that famous story of Siddhartha's cousin shooting the swan with the bow and arrow? Unke cousin the, unhone teer mara aur wo gir gaya. So the cousin said, this is my swan. Kyunki maine mara hai, to ye mera hai. But Siddharth is the one who ran to the swan to look after it. Ki wo theek hai ya nahi theek hai, wo dauda. He cared for the swan. To kiska tha? So they went to the father, each saying, this is my swan. And the father said, there's only one way to resolve this. You stand there, and you stand there, and which way the swan goes, it belongs to that person. Does it go to the one who shot it, or to the one who took care of it? So it's quite futile to say, this is mine. You may think it's yours. Is it yours? Is anything yours? Is the money in your pocket yours, or did it come from somewhere, from your hard work? Who gave you the ability to work hard? Is it yours, or did it come from somewhere? Name one thing which is yours. Is your life yours? Any questions? This is your friend. You've come before, right? No, first time. You got him. Sure. See, everyone has different temperaments. We are all not the same. Each path is equally valid. There is no path which is better than another one. So someone who is inclined to a Kriya Yoga practice will follow that path, because ultimately all paths lead to the same destination. The point what usually happens, what we don't realize, is we follow many paths simultaneously without knowing why we are doing that. That is what tends to happen. People tend to get involved in Reiki, pranic healing, this, that, Kriya Yoga. So if you ask yourself, what am I looking for and what path is giving me what I am looking for? If you know what you're looking for, which invariably is peace of mind, and you identify the path which is giving you a taste of that peace, then stick to that path. Because as Maharaj said, to find water, do you dig deep in one place or do you dig many shallow wells all over the place? That is what I meant by saying that if you are doing many things, it could either be that you're just acquiring, in this case, experiences and paths and techniques, etc. Or it could be you have not asked yourself that what am I hoping to get by this exercise. So if you know what is it you want, then by all means keep trying out paths till you find that path which gives you what you want. But you must ask yourself this question, otherwise life will be all about just trying different paths, different techniques, doing 10 different things, because it has become a process of acquiring. So Jnana Yoga, the path of Jnana Yoga, of abiding in your being, for example, as Maharaj refers to it as Jnana Yoga, is one such path, but it may not suit your temperament. Someone else might want to be a Vipassana practitioner because they get what they are looking for from the Vipassana practice. But at the same time, you could be a Vipassana practitioner but have no peace of mind. It's possible. Anything is possible. So therefore, they have to ask themselves, is what I am involved in, is the path I'm following, giving me that which I'm looking for? And it is part of one's journey to try out different things initially. It's very rare that, you know, you would go straight to find one and you're happy with that. But this should not be an unconscious journey of moving around and acquiring and jumping from guru to guru and all. That is also meant to be, but that happens because that is that awareness is not there. It becomes entertainment sometimes. I have to keep myself busy. That also happens. That is why if you find that one thing, that one teaching, that one technique, stick to that. Trust it. Because this is also lack of trust when you're all over the place. Trust that one thing. Trust is a very important component of seeking. Do you not trust your parents when you're a child? You trust them blindly, right? Because they know more than you. Do you not trust your school teacher because your teacher is teaching you? It's all about trust. Why would anyone tell you, any master tell you things and then you approach that with distrust? You must trust. You may question it. Ask questions. See if you get the answers which satisfy you. But beyond that, because there's no end to the number of questions the mind can come up with, there's trust. That is why Maharaj said that if you are in prison and there are people outside who are going to help you escape, are you going to keep asking them, are you sure I should take a left, I should not go right? Are you sure I should leave at 3:40 p.m. and not at 3:45 p.m? Or are you going to trust that because they are outside prison working for your release, you must trust the instructions in order to get out? That's a very beautiful example he has given. Because they are the ones outside. It needs courage to trust. It's very easy to not trust. Even this jumping from gurus to gurus is not trusting one's guru. Or not asking oneself, why am I jumping? I have people here who give big names, so-and-so is my guru. Are you following their teaching? No, but I even like what you're saying. Okay, fair enough. I have no problem. But if that person is your guru, are you following what they are? Then why are you sending an email here when this is my life situation, this is my problem, what do I do? You should follow your guru's teaching, right? Where is the trust in that relationship? People ask gurus, are you my guru? No genuine guru is going to say, yes, I am your guru. It is up to the student. The guru is the projection of the higher self of the individual. In Ramesh's early days, someone asked him this question, are you my guru? Ramesh said, it depends. So that man said, on what? He said, if you're my disciple, then I'm your guru. He didn't say, yes, I am your guru. Because the guru does not consider himself as a guru. He does not consider himself separate from the disciple. He sees an aspect of himself in front of him. A true guru is not going to say, I am your guru. What is the word guru? It means the remover of ignorance. We have mistakenly thought of it as someone who comes in robes and thinks he knows best. The guru is the dispeller of darkness, the remover of ignorance, the one who shines light on your journey of life. Is there someone who does that in your life? It could be your building watchman, I don't know. It could be a friend who's been doing that. That is what the word guru means, not an individual. That is the whole point. We have just got fixed on the stereotyped image of a guru. And in our Indian scriptures, the guru is God in human form. So what is your relationship with your guru? God as in consciousness. What is your dynamic? What is your equation? Or do you go to your guru satsangs and then you look at the watch and you say, okay, now I'm meeting my friends at Starbucks for coffee, so I'm going to leave 20 minutes earlier. Is that your equation? Try doing it to a Nath yogi. Try taking your chances with them. I've seen it happen. They have a short fuse. The lineage I went to were living room gurus. They didn't care. You try doing this nonsense with a Nath yogi and see how you get whacked. That is why you have to ask their permission. Is it okay if I leave now? Not because of some egocentric activity on the yogi's part. Because of the reverence of what they represent as agents of the divine. It happened so many times with Shirdi Sai Baba. He would tell someone that leave 4 hours later. And if they didn't listen to him, something bad would happen to them on the way. Because he had seen it, he had the vision. So we are very casual in our association and relationship with whom we call our gurus, you know. And after a few years, we think we are on the same level. I mentioned the story once of a Sufi mystic in a small town in Kashmir I had met. He used to smoke the hookah. He still smokes the hookah. So couples who wanted to get married would come to him for his blessings, because he was quite famous for, you know, getting the right people together, blessing them and all whatever. And his right-hand man was there for many, many years. Now, once he went to a village to help someone, and one couple came. They had told him they were coming, but he went on an emergency. So the right-hand man said that he's gone, but, you know, y'all are a couple in love. I don't want to delay the process. I have witnessed my master doing this for many years. I know the words he speaks and what he does, and I'll bless y'all. They were very happy, and he blessed them, and they went. Now, when the Sufi master came back, he was furious when he heard that this had happened. But he didn't say anything. He sat down on his gadi, lit up the hookah, started smoking it, while all his disciples were watching him, the right-hand man was there. And then he picked up a coal from the hookah bowl and he ate it. And then he looked at his right-hand man and said, "Now you please do exactly what I have done, because I heard you're very good at it." You can imagine his plight. There was a very big sage in North India. I'm not sure it was Chidanand Saraswati or who, but he was giving a, you know, I think it was the Bhagavat or lecture on some scripture. And he was shocked when he arrived that they had not made a podium for him to sit and address the audience. He was on the same ground with a carpet. Everyone else was sitting and the mic was placed for him. So he thought about it and then he insisted. He said, "How dare the organizers make me sit down? They should have at least created a platform." And the first row said, "Look at this man's ego. He wants to be on a higher ground because he's giving the lecture." This master was very aware of what was happening in the audience. And he started the lecture by saying, "You all think that I insisted on this podium because I want to project myself as a guru and give a lecture. But it is not me you are respecting as the body. It is the teaching which you are respecting, which is coming from my mouth. And I insist that you look up to the teaching. That is why I have insisted on sitting on this elevated platform and not down on the ground." But we don't look at things that way.